I want to call your attention to the book of Job, chapter 2. Job, chapter 2. As we think of this very difficult topic and subject, in fact, more than a topic, more than a subject, it's a reality, suffering. Job, chapter 2, verses 8 to 10. I'll read verse 7 to 10, for even though we'll be looking in the entire book this morning in about 20 minutes. So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he's in your hands, in your power, only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sores, boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." May the words of my mouth and the meditation in our hearts be acceptable, O God, to you through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. The fact of the abundance of suffering, human suffering, disasters of all kinds, at home and abroad, experienced by people we know and people we don't know, that fact alone draws a sense of empathy, more than sympathy, from us. It causes all who observes, it causes all to ask one vivid question, a question that we heard already expressed this morning. Why? Why? Lord Tennyson said this, "Not a morning begun, not a day end, but some heart has been broken." Why? Centuries have passed. And from the humblest to the most exalted individual, from the uneducated to the educated, mankind has been trying to find some answer to the problem of evil and suffering. And if they, men such as Augustine and others contemporary, have tried and have not come up with a suitable solution, I want to inform you this morning that I will not do it in 20 minutes. My intention this morning is to share with you some thoughts, some of which you have already heard. And my conclusion is this. The problems of evil and suffering will never be solved on this side of eternity, but it can be resolved on this side of eternity. It will never be solved, but it can be resolved. This is what we find from the book of Job. So we look in the book of Job, verse 7, we see two things, or three things, may I say. Suffering is real. Suffering is not the figment of the imagination. There is a certain group of people who say that suffering is really in the mind, it really doesn't really exist. Well, this is not true. Suffering is real. Consider with me three little thoughts from Job chapter 2. First of all, suffering is perplexing. It is very, very perplexing. If we read verse 7 of our text, we come up with this one statement. God said to Satan, "Job is in your hands. Do whatever you want with him, but don't touch his life. Don't touch who he really is." And Satan went out from the presence of God, and Job came down with boils. Here was a righteous man. Here was a godly man. Here was a man of integrity. And all of a sudden, without any information, without any introduction, he is struck with a disease for which he could not find any suitable answer. One does not have to wait until one is old to understand. Colleen had to tell her 4-year-old daughter. From the time she should be experiencing the joys of life, she is confronted with suffering. Your brother is not coming home. The agony of it. The perplexing times of not being able to sleep and come to some final answer intellectually, even emotionally. The reality of suffering, trying to understand why this has happened. Concluding that there seems to be a mockery of the divine because he's so big and I'm so little, and yet there seems to be no answer for it. Bertrand Russell, the great British mathematician, said this: I have lived to see wars in life. I have traveled to see sufferings in God. And from my conclusion, there could never be a God if these things exist. Perplexing thing. The reality of it causes one to ask whether there is some God. Theologians and philosophers used to try to deal with suffering this way. If suffering exists and God exists, then there has to be some conclusions. If suffering exists and God exists, then God must be good, but not powerful. For if he is not able to stop suffering, then all his generosity means nothing if he can't stop what is causing people severe pains. If he is not powerful, and if he's good is not powerful, then perhaps he's powerful, but he isn't good. For if he has the power to stop evil and suffering, why doesn't he do it? And so the perplexing conclusion is that if God really exists, then he must be so incapable of dealing with the realities that human beings go through that I can't believe in him. Conclusion, Bertrand Russell. The perplexity of suffering. But suffering is not only perplexing. Suffering involves people. People. The text tells us that it was Job who suffered. It was not some abstract thought, not some disaster over in India, not an earthquake, but a human being. And do not forget that even the earthquakes involved the destruction of human life. But what I want to bring to you this morning is this. Suffering involves people you know, people I know. I was in Chicago. I was just sitting down to have supper. The phone rang. It was my wife, half tears, trying to tell me something. She said, Ian Brown just died. Here I was 500 miles away. I knew the father. I knew the mother. I knew the child. It involved people that I knew, people that you know. Suffering is not some abstract thought. It involves people. I was in my office in Don Mills. I was sitting down studying. The phone rang. It was Elaine Quantz. Please meet us at the hospital. Heidi has just had an accident. Playing on the street with a baby carriage, the spring broke loose right into her eyes. Took her vision away immediately. I got to the hospital. The grandfather was there. John was there. Elaine was there. Little Chris was there. Suffering involves people. This is what makes it so hard, especially when those people are near to you, especially when you've known them for a while, especially when you've shared joys with them, and all of a sudden you're called upon now to share sorrows. Suffering involves people. You heard me a few weeks ago when I was in Oregon. My sister-in-law, right height, right size, right face, just a beautiful, beautiful bride some 20 years ago. Today, she's suffering from brain tumors. She's dying. And I can go on. But these are people. And the closer they are to us, the more perplexing and difficult it is to deal with it. Because suffering involves people we love. Conclusion, if I could love them and I would do anything to prevent them from suffering this way, why isn't God doing anything about it? Suffering is painful. It is perplexing. It involves people. It is painful. Look, if you please, at Job in chapter 2 and verse 8. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. What an agonizing experience that must have been. How painful it must have been for Job to have to take a scraper to get the skin, the flesh off his bones. May I suggest to you that no one could experience the pain, even though you may have felt some sympathy for Colleen this morning. You could never begin to experience what she experienced. You never knew the night seasons. You never knew when meals made no sense at all because there was no appetite. Only those who go through the pains of suffering truly understands it. More can be said, but I want to give you a bird's eye view of the reality of suffering. It is perplexing, it involves people, and it is painful. I wish I had liberty to share more with you, but I don't. But if suffering is, first of all, real, suffering, my friends, is also resisted. Every time we try to find a reason for it, we are trying to resist it. Every time we try to explain it, we're trying to resist it. Nobody likes to suffer. One of the reasons I think I'd make a poor missionary is because I can't even look at blood. I can't look at a snake. I refuse to. And every time I think of it, not for me. It's true. I confess that. So I try to resist it one way or another. Let's look at the book of Job and see how suffering was resisted. By resisting, I mean again that I'm trying to find some reason for it, some explanation for it. I'm trying to put a handle on it. And so what do I do? First of all, it is resisted by those who are experiencing it. And they resist it by saying, why me? Why me? It is possible for me to name a dozen people who may deserve this, but I don't deserve it. Look at the way I take care of my home. Look at the way I contribute to my community. Look at the way I treat my parents. Why me? Let me suggest to you that that's not a bad question. Because Job asked the same question. In fact, at one point, Job said to God, why are you picking on me? You are so great and I'm so little. Why are you picking on me? Job said, I wish you would leave me alone. I can't take this uncertainty. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said that it is not the difficulty of life that sometimes it tries to make sense that I have to deal with. It is not the difficulty of life that sometimes it doesn't make sense that I have to deal with. It is sometimes that it makes sense and sometimes it doesn't. I don't know when I can. Someone said to me recently, it is getting to the place in my life now that when the phone rings, I ask, I wonder what's wrong now. Suffering is resisted by those who experience it. Look at Job 7, 20 and 21. Job 7, verses 20 and 21. I will read it to save time. Listen to Job. Have I sinned? What have I done to thee? Oh, watchers of men, why hast thou set me in thy as thy target, so that I am a burden to myself? Why then dost thou not pardon my transgression? If something is wrong, why don't you have mercy on me? But why do you allow me to go through this? He's trying to put a handle on it. He looks within, and the trouble with Job is that when he looked within, he didn't see anything that deserved it. And when he looked at God, he just saw God as a cosmic bully. Why are you making me your target? Why not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in dust, and thou wilt seek me, but I will not be. Why me? The phone rang just a few days ago. It was a friend from another location. And she said, my son's marriage has just broken up. He is so angry. He is so angry at God. He called his sister and complained to his sister, asking, why is God doing this to me? And his sister very wise, said, when you were experiencing good things, you didn't recognize God. Why are you now recognizing him in your pain? Sister said that. Only a sister would say that. But it's true, isn't it? We never think that God is making me the target until something goes wrong in my life. That's what Job said. Why are you making me a target? So suffering is resisted by those experiencing it. Suffering is resisted by those observing it. Suffering is resisted by those observing it. From why me to the one who's experiencing it, to why God to the one observing it. Listen to his wife. Why don't you just curse God and die? Why don't you just close the books on God? Why don't you just turn your back on God? For if God is God, I can't see how a loving God could ever do something like this and take an innocent child and cause him to suffer the way he has. Curse God. Now I have one question. Supposing you curse God, what will that do to God? You know who suffers when you curse God? The one who curses God. The one who curses God now has nothing to call to. No handle that they can reach to. If I turn my back on God in my suffering, then I'm all alone. And the worst experience of suffering is not to suffer, but to suffer alone. That's the worst experience of suffering. To suffer alone. To know that there is just the thick darkness out there and there is no face behind it. No face behind it. To see God as simply being a vindictive God is to hate God not only because of who he is, but hate him because of what he's doing or not doing. If God is the only hope and you curse him, then you live without hope. And when hope dies, you only hope to die yourself. Suffering is resisted by those experiencing it. Suffering is resisted by those observing it. But suffering is also resisted by those trying to explain it. From point one, we go to, why me? Then we go to, why God? And then we come to, here's the answer. Here's the answer. Job's three friends. Now, if all that was said of Job's three friends is the first part of their experience with Job, history would be much kinder to them. When they went to Job, they looked at him, they began to cry, they shared his tears with him. They looked at him, they empathized with him because they couldn't understand, they couldn't even recognize him. And for 7 days, they sat in silence. I'm sure they're not theological students. Because if they were theological students, they'd be trying to find some theological handle for it. They're philosophers. Theological philosophers. And they always try to find an answer. I won't go through all of it this morning. But just give you just a thumbnail sketch of each of their arguments, the ones who are resisting it. Eliphaz. Eliphaz is the oldest of Job's three friends. And he goes first. He speaks first because it is the custom of the day that the oldest always have the responsibility of speaking out. And he told Job something. Look at chapter 2. He has a very interesting thing he said to Job. Job chapter 2, see if I, chapter 4. Eliphaz said, Job, your problem is this. There is something wrong with your life. There is sin in your life. That's the reason it's happening. What God is doing, he's repaying you for what you've been doing in secret that nobody knows about. Isn't that a terrible thing to say? If someone suffers, it's because you're sinning? That philosophy still reigns, by the way. People think if something is wrong, there must be something wrong with the one who's experiencing the experience. But look at Eliphaz. He said this. I love this. As he began to speak, um, Verse 13. Amidst disquieting thoughts from the vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me and trembling and made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed by my face. The hair of my flesh bristled up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. Wow. Isn't that an answer for suffering? What is he doing? Here is a man who is in distress, and he is telling the man about his experience. Have you not met people like that? You tell them what toothache you have, and they say, oh, let me tell you of one I had. The experience, no personal experience, my friends, should ever be the foundation upon which we try to find answers for life. No personal experience should ever be the foundation upon which we try to build a foundation for life. It won't work, because what works today won't work tomorrow. So for him, it was his experience. There's sin in your life. That's the reason. Bildad. Bildad said to Job, you know what, Job? What is wrong is that you are not willing to admit that God is bigger than you. You want to be like God. And all you have to do is to submit. Here is the theological fact. God is sovereign. So shut up. That's what he's saying. Then comes Zophar. Zophar says, Job, you know what your problem is? You talk too much. You are nothing but a windbag. Read it. He said, if you would just stop talking for a minute and listen, you would learn something. And then later on, Elihu comes. He listens to the three elder statesmen trying to solve this problem, to try and find an answer. And he comes to Job and he says, Job, I'll tell you what the problem is. And we'll come to that in a minute. Suffering is real. Suffering is resisted. Suffering is resolved. Suffering is resolved. From chapter 4 to chapter 36, there is the passion for a resolve of suffering. Verbal exchange with Elihu. Verbal exchange with Bildad. Verbal exchange, and they go through all the experiences of one friend to another, trying to put a handle on it, and from one thing to the next, but no answer was found. Job said something through his own spiritual experience, his spiritual explanation, chapter 23, verse 10, which is a favorite verse of mine. But he knows the way that I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. You know, Job is saying two things there. Job is saying, I believe in God. I believe that he is omniscient. He knows everything. I believe he's omnipresent. He's everywhere present. He knows what I'm going through. Listen, here's one of the things Job is saying. And when he has tried me with my suffering, he will find out that I didn't deserve it. That's what he's saying. I shall come forth as gold. Gold is pure. He'll find that I was pure. And he did me wrong by doing this. You see what happened to Job? From chapter 2, when he was able to say, wife, what are you talking about? And as his friends spoke with him, he became bitter and resentful. He became resistant to God because nobody was giving him an answer. And when you don't have an answer from an experience you're going through, such as suffering, you tend to resent. You tend to become angry. You tend to become bitter. You tend to lash out. You tend to just stay back in silence. But nobody knows what's burning inside of you. So he says, he knows the way that I take. And when he's finished, I shall be like gold. But then let me quickly go on. Not only do we have the passion for resolve, there is something that drives us to try to find an answer. There is a providence. There's a providence in suffering. There's a providence in suffering. Look at the process. Look at the process of that providence. God speaks for the first time in all of this And Job is confronted with questions. God doesn't address his whys. God asks him some burning questions because he said, I wish I could find God. I would ask him to answer some of my questions. And God says, Job, I have some questions for you. And God asked him about creation. God asked him about the design of creation. And God said to Job, Job, there are things that you see and you appreciate, but you don't understand them, yet you enjoy them. And God is using design to try to show Job something, that life is bigger than the experience of any one individual or a whole nation, if you please. See, when we come to a conclusion about suffering, it's not solving it, it's resolving it. And so God asks questions. You see, questions have a way of making us own up to certain things. That's why it was a tactic, if you please, of Jesus to always ask questions. And so there was the process of providence, asking questions to shut one up to oneself. There is the purpose of providence. I want you to see Job chapter 42. And I'm hasting here because the time is up. It's just about up. Job 42. 2-6. Then Job answered the Lord, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have declared that which I did not understand. Dear friends, Colleen, my own brother-in-law, my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, and anyone in this audience this morning, the purpose of providence is to cause us to see that beyond human suffering, there is the human condition. All of us want answer because we feel that God should be obligated to me when I face difficulties. I should have an answer. I demand an answer. And if you read the book of Job, he's saying, I demand an answer from God. Even to the place where I will make God, if you please, quote unquote, look bad so that I can justify myself. And God, he brought Job to the place through his suffering where Job said, the thing I did not understand, what I did not understand, that faith in God in the midst of suffering leads to prayer to God for comfort in suffering. Because faith alone simply looks at the condition of suffering and say, why God? But prayer through faith looks to God and say, I don't know how to pray, but the Spirit will help me to pray because He's able to take the groanings of my heart and take them to God. I see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. The purpose of providence is to cause you and me to know our limitation in life, to expose to us that which is worse than suffering. Worse than suffering, my friends, is a heart that has to suffer without God who is there. That's what God is telling Job. I am there. I am there with you. I'm there in it with you. What's the perspective? It is this. I close with this. Faith keeps me from fatalism in suffering. And prayer sustains me. Prayer sustains me from being fatalism. It keeps me. Faith makes me look at it. And prayer sustains me in it. What is the perspective then? Because I am not God, there are things in this life I will never understand. Job teaches us that the exercise of faith, not blind, thoughtless submission to an impersonal status quo, but faith in God who has graciously revealed himself to us. That I can resolve the problem of faith, of suffering in this life. No man has the ability to solve it. Eugene Clark wrote for Back to the Bible broadcast for years and years, never saw a sunset, never saw a sunrise. He was stricken with multiple sclerosis. He couldn't move from his room. He wrote one of the songs we love to sing, and I close with this. Nothing is impossible when you put your trust in God. Nothing is impossible when you're trusting in His word. Hearken to the voice of God to thee. Is there anything too hard for me? Then put your trust, oh, put your trust, oh, put your trust in God, for nothing is impossible with God. What am I wanting in suffering? I don't only want an answer. I want someone who is bigger than the suffering, who is able to bring something out of it that will shape me into what I can become for him and bring glory to him.